An urban planet, are we ready? A 21st century challenge, urbanisation and climate change. This is the second forum in the 2013 Fenner School Forum Series, hosted by the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. This forum took place on the 16th of April 2013. The views and opinions expressed in this recording are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Australian National University.
Welcome everyone. Sorry for a slightly delayed start, but as you might be aware, there's another event downstairs. So if you're actually interested in the hydrology of coal seam gas, this is the urban. Okay, good. I'm Steve Dovers, Director of the Fenner School, and welcome and thank you very much for coming along. This event follows five fora of a similar style we ran last year, which covered forests, water, agriculture, soils, biodiversity. This focuses on urban, and there will be a forthcoming one on climate. A couple of housekeepings, the event will be recorded, so you know that. Afterwards, people are welcome in the next building, follow the crowd to come along for refreshments afterwards. And if you do put your business card in the glass bowl out there, one of you will win a rather nice bottle of red wine. And could you turn your mobiles on silent? And before we begin, I would acknowledge on behalf of the university and school, the Australia's first people whose lands we meet on here today, and pay my respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, both past and present. And now I will simply introduce Professor Shumei Bai, Professor of Urban Environment at the Fenner School, who will be in control tonight.
Thank you, Steve, for the introduction. Good evening and welcome everyone again. Thank you all for coming to this first seminar of Fenner Seminar Series in 2013, which is entitled An Urban Planet, Are We Ready? For the next hour or so, I think we will be exploring the challenges and opportunities that are brought about by urbanization, and also what are the skills that are required to actually effectively respond to that kind of challenge. To justify our title, which says The Urban Planet, I would like to start with a couple of a series of numbers. First of all, it is more than half of the world population now living in cities. I think many of you already know that. And according to the UN prediction, by 2030, more than 60% of world population will be urban dwellers. And if we push that time frame a bit further, by 2050, this number will be increased to 70%. And we have to remember that this increase is happening in the backdrop of net increase of world population, which means that an additional 3 billion people will be added to our cities. And if we look at where this population are going, it looks like more than 95% of the net increase of this global population by 2050 will be going to cities in developing world, including Asia and Pacific. And this global trend of urban growth will be very much echoed if it is not amplified in Australia, actually. And this seems to be a surprise to many people, including one of my colleagues the other day was saying, you know, urbanization, isn't that what is finished in Australia? Isn't that a phenomenon that is happening in Asia and, you know, Pacific or Africa? Well, let me give you another number. By the Australian Bureau of Statistics, number which says by 2050, the Australian population will be over 62.2 million. And that is an increase of 40 million from today's 23 million. And if we look at the urbanization ratio in Australia today, which is already over 90% living in cities, guess what? Most of this 40 million population will be going into cities again. So Australia very much will be sharing the promise and peril of urbanization with Asia and other rapidly urbanizing regions. And such transition in human settlement is actually unprecedented in magnitude and speed, and it certainly raises many questions at the very least. For example, what kind of challenges will be awaiting us down the road, both within Australia and internationally, and what are the new opportunities arising? Are we ready for an urban planet, for example? Do we have enough and sufficient scientific understanding of our cities as complex socio-ecological systems? And do we have sufficient capacity to effectively plan, manage, and govern our cities? And what kind of skills are required, and how can our education and training system meet these challenges? So we'll try to explore some of these questions with three speakers today. First of all, I think you have seen all of us, we just took a picture up here. First of all, our esteemed colleague, Emeritus Professor Patrick Choi, AO. Patrick is over there. I think Patrick had a very long and successful career in Australian urban research. He has published extensively with lots of books and academic journal articles, and the most recent one being Accommodating Australians, Commonwealth Government Involvement in Housing. And I think it is fair to say that Patrick has played a pivotal role in conducting urban research and also analyzing, shaping, and indeed criticizing Australian urban policy. And our second speaker will be, next speaker will be Rob Thorman, Director of Sustainability and Innovation in the ACT Land Development Agency. Rob is here. Rob is an expert in environmental planning and sustainability with over 30 years professional experience. He had worked extensively with local government throughout Australia on regional planning, urban design, and environmental management, including dealing with the issue around greenfield development and the challenge of infilling, infill development. Rob has been involved in the development of Green Building Council of Australian Green Star System, which is a community rating tool in association with other government land organizations. And he's an adjunct fellow at Fenner School, and at his spare time, he's also a student at Canberra Institute of Technology for a diploma in architectural drafting. So we're very happy to have him here today. And the last speaker will be Ed Boido from Climate Change, from Care Australia, and he's a climate change advisor to this well-known major environmental development NGO. And Ed's responsibility at CARE Australia includes designing and providing technical support to climate change adaptation projects in developing countries and climate change advocacy and looking at the implications of climate change for CARE's program in developing countries. And before joining CARE, Ed was an Australian Youth Ambassador for Development to Vietnam, working with Vietnamese youth organizations to raise awareness and develop action and advocacy strategies related to climate change. And Ed is also an alumni of ANU and the Fenner School, and he has completed a Bachelor of Philosophy, which is in science, which is one of the very elite sort of program within ANU. I would like to ask Rob Thorman to go first. Actually, Rob is charged with questions such as how ACT is responding to the challenges of increasing urban population and the demand for more housing and infrastructure, and what are the underlying considerations behind some of the policy decisions, and what are the new opportunities arising from such new development and urbanization in general. So, Rob.
Okay, good afternoon. Yes, as Shri May said, I'm with the Land Development Agency. My background's actually in ecology, but I've sort of drifted into the urban environment. And I just want to go through some of the challenges that we're facing within the ACT. Just to give a little bit of background to the Land Development Agency and the work that we do, like other land organisations, land government organisations around Australia, we're involved in estate planning. This is a site just north of the University of Canberra, Lawson, one of the suburbs that we've been doing the planning for. And we're also involved in estate construction. So these are some examples of the early impact that that we have on the landscape before houses go on. That's Molonglo in the top and the suburbs to the north of Gungahlin. Bonner and Ford. So we generally don't deal with buildings, but we influence the built form. So in relation to energy, one of the initiatives that we've taken in our most recent suburbs is to provide solar access. So it basically prevents overshadowing of neighbours to the south. So the idea is to make sure that people have the opportunity for solar access and for passive solar design. Some of the other initiatives in relation to energy are rebates or mandating solar hot water systems, which is one of the big big ways of reducing energy at the home level. And also, I'll just touch on water. In terms of the way we develop our suburbs these days, it's quite different to what used to happen in the early suburbs, the inner parts of Canberra with concrete drains. We're very much trying to establish wetlands, and this raises the issue also around climate adaptation. How do we plan for more extreme climatic events in the future, for flash flooding, and making sure we're planting the right species and allowing canopy so that we can try and moderate the more severe impacts of climate change. So just to set the context for Canberra, I'm fortunate to meet with a group of sustainability officers from other government land organisations around the country, and issues that we're all grappling with are sustainability, innovation and housing affordability. And the tension that exists between greenfields development and infill. But Canberra's a little bit different from other cities around Australia. You know, we have a unique history as a planned city and also some unique opportunities. So I'll just, it's timely in this our centennial year to just go back just briefly over some of Canberra's planning history. The original vision for Canberra, as expressed in the Griffin's plan 100 years ago, was for quite a compact city. But as time changed, some of the original plans, the more detailed design for compact inner city living, hasn't been realised. That this photo shows large areas of really unused land that this has really been left over around car development, around freeways, and so we'll come back to that in terms of some of the opportunities. So before Canberra really had the chance to grow into itself, the era of the car came aboard, and this wasn't unique to Canberra. There's maps that look like this of all our major cities, the growth corridors, and the idea was to get people out of the cities, the congestion of the inner city, and with the motor car becoming more common for people to move out into the suburbs, and that certainly shaped Canberra's development right up until really the beginning of this. By 2004, there was tension between greenfield and infill development starting to manifest, and the idea was then to try and constrain growth, and so this outer line was the line beyond which it was not considered wise to have more development, and then the inner line was where we were looking at urban intensification. That was the thinking in 2004. And that really led to changes in the territory plan that led to Molonglo, which is now the new suburbs that we're developing. So we moved away from the Y plan. And at the same time, the National Capital Authority was looking at the Griffin legacy, at revisiting the original Griffin plan and trying to revitalise some of the more inner city areas. And even more recently, again, up till last year, it was realised those concentric circles was a bit of a blunt instrument, and it didn't really recognise transport corridors. And so the current thinking is the green fields in the brown areas, so Molonglo and the rest of Gungahlin, but then looking at opportunities for intensification along transport corridors and around the town centres. And that's really the current planning framework, and with policies of 50-50 greenfields, infill development. So that sets the context for my work at the Land Development Agency. So some of the current trends in Canberra that we're all probably aware of, if you're driving around the city, we're getting large houses on the perimeter of the city. But also getting smaller apartments in the infill sites closer to the city. And in new estates, we're getting a mix of housing, more compact, affordable, terrace-style housing, as well as larger houses. So why are people moving into the inner city? Transport is a major issue, both the time taken and the costs. We've got shifting demographics and an aging population. People don't necessarily want a big backyard anymore. Housing is very expensive, and young people are leaving home later, So there's sort of pressure for more compact housing to alleviate some of those affordability issues. And people are also more and more wanting to be connected and be close to the action. A lot of people don't want to be remote in the outer suburbs. So they're reasons why people might choose. But issues that we're facing, from our perspective, there are enormous ecological constraints on growth to the edge of the cities. Everywhere where there's development proposed, we're coming up against rare and threatened species and communities and Commonwealth referrals, which are really slowing down development. So that's another constraint, ecological constraints, as well as the infrastructure costs of putting new suburbs out into new areas. One of the major challenges for us is providing affordable housing, particularly in those infill sites, which are highly sought after. This is an example of some of our own place housing that's providing a sort of compact housing. So new ways of living. The Nishi building close to here is providing, for example, this is your only models, but that's a house that doesn't actually have a bedroom. So it's the living area and you fold away the bed. It's sort of designed by a Japanese architect. It mightn't necessarily suit what we're used to, but this is what's on the market and people are buying it. So new ways of working. People are not necessarily driving to work 9 to 5. People can work from home. They don't have to necessarily have an office. This is the Green Building Council in Sydney. I just sort of observed the different ways people were working. So to address some of these challenges, the government land organisations around the country have all got demonstration precincts. We've got Lochiel Park in South Australia and the Nicholson, which is done with modular construction, a mixed-use development in Melbourne. So we're all keeping in touch with each other, trying to work out how we can make sure that we've got the best available technologies for energy efficiency and innovative construction technologies. The project we're working on in Molonglo is a compact housing development in the new suburb of Coombs. It's aiming to demonstrate compact, energy-efficient living with open space provided in communal courts rather than large gardens. And it's basically demonstrating an alternative both to apartment living and detached housing. So it has the advantage people can have their own infrastructure, hot water systems, solar hot water systems and PV panels on the roof and be independent. They're separately titled. So it's compact living but as an alternative to apartment living. Some of the other projects, infill projects we're working on at the moment is Campbell Section 5 on the corner of Anzac Parade and Constitution Avenue. And another project that's currently open for public consultation is the City to the Lake proposal. So this comes back to that early shot I showed of the really underutilised land in the inner part of the city. And this is an analysis that's been done of the amount of space that's taken up by roads. That space is really not very accessible. It's not usable space in any way. So the proposal that we're looking at the moment is not burying Parkes Way in a tunnel, but submerging it in a channel, which would allow the originally planned road network to be reinstated to allow access down to the lake. And some of the images that are currently out for display like this that would actually allow access, better access across the Commonwealth Park and from the city down to the lake. So in terms of, just very briefly in closing, the challenges that I see from our industry for the future, as development gets more compact, there's a greater need to integrate various disciplines. It's not like you produce the land and then the architect comes on and the builder comes on. Everything is much more integrated. So the need to integrate disciplines, architects, planners, and sociologists as well. How do we develop community life in these more compact spaces? There's real challenges around high quality public domain as there's less private open space. Creating spaces that really work, that people are inspired to go and become active and meet with the neighbours. And that also includes the development of higher quality apartments if people are going to move into more compact living, issues around privacy, good acoustic quality, generous decks. And I think the new Acton is a good example of that. And also engaging the community in decision making, taking people along with the discussion on intensification and new forms of urban living. Okay. That's it from me.
Our next speaker is Pat Choi, Professor Pat Choi. And Pat will be giving us his view on where our current understanding of cities as complex socio-ecological system is, and how this understanding are applied or misapplied in decision making in Australia, and what are the remaining tasks from an academic point of view.
Thank you. Thank you, Shabai. Well, I've got quite a different pace of conversation and from a quite different perspective to the one you've just heard, so please bear with me. Given that we're supposed to be discussing whether or not we're going to have an urban nation, I just want to start by making the point that since invasion in 1788, we've been an urban species. We've even managed to do so overriding or disregarding the rights and traditions of the indigenous populations in their accommodations with the natural world. We now, however, have to confront the realities of living in the complex social ecosystems that constitute the nation. We are discovering that there are real limits to growth, and they are directly and materially affect the stability of natural ecosystems and the way we live. We've developed cities that concentrate people and power into small areas. In doing so, we exploit the natural resources on their hinterlands, usually with scant regard or attention to the consequences for the natural systems on which we depend. Having exploited all the potable water resource in the immediate areas of our cities, we garner it from other ecosystems. We cause huge stresses in the ecosystems from which we extract the water to transport it to the cities where it's used. The sullied water produced in the cities is then discharged to other ecosystems with scant concern for the environmental consequences. All the time, we ignore the water that falls in the cities, treating it as stormwater, but which in turn becomes the greatest source of pollution and degradation of the harbours, rivers and bays on which the cities are built. This Mad Hatter's Tea Party approach pollutes the near ocean areas of our cities and contributes to the acidification of the ocean, increasing the climate change processes as well as compromising the marine systems in them. Patrick Mullins found some 30 years ago one of the reasons for the reasons that our urban populations were bigger and healthier than their forefathers was largely due to the systematic domestic production and consumption of food when a significant proportion of the food consumed in our cities was actually produced in them, but we ignored him. In spite of these outcomes, we have pursued with great energy policies designed to increase our number and centralise more of our population into growth into smaller areas. The growth of our cities now exhibits a range of environmental and social stresses. So we now pursue a policy of densification, also called consolidation, allegedly to reduce those stresses. For the last 20 years, politicians and planning authorities have pursued such physical determinist policies. Planners with no serious analytical training or understanding of the processes at work in the city simply assert the alleged desperate need to change the nature and character of the Australian city. Support for the policy seems to have several origins. One of them is that there seems to be a concern over overpopulation. The second is that there's a concern that too much land was being used for urban areas. And thirdly, over excess consumption of precious natural areas. These concerns were also articulated as leading to extensive cities, often referred to in pejorative terms as urban sprawl. We need to understand, however, the drivers of city growth lies in two very fundamental aspirations that have been in existence throughout much of our civilization. The first is that there's a strong desire for people to make themselves comfortable and to have control over their living space. They have also wanted to have control over external space, hence their desire for gardens, not only for food production, but also for the gratifications they could experience in gardening. As their societies prospered, communities also wanted spaces in which they could assemble, in which they could participate in a range of social activities, hence the demand for sporting facilities, parks, promenade sites, etc. The second influence was what we might call the curiosity factor. It was the desire for people to metaphorically to see over the hill. This manifested itself in the development of forms of transport to enable people to extend their horizons with as little personal effort as could be managed. This led to forms of transport that relied on higher levels of technology. The economic development that enabled people to fulfil their ambitions about the kinds of spaces they wanted in their cities and how to take advantage of the freedoms the two aspirations promised found expression in the nature of Australian cities, producing housing and urban conditions that were generally felicitous. This led to a form of development which had sufficient land attached to them to meet household needs of fresh milk, vegetables, fruit and protein production, as well as managing human body wastes. The ready availability of land resulted in a form of development described today as the quarter acre block in rather derisive terms. That characterised what became the suburban spread of the cities. This form of development offered an opportunity for households of all rank and station to enjoy a higher standard of living than their forefathers had experienced. Some commentators now, however, claim that the size of the cities was affecting city efficiency and that this efficiency could be increased by increasing density. No attention was paid to the problem of over-centralisation, which is the primary cause of most of the so-called inefficiencies and most so-called urban problems. The concern over overpopulation could have been met by a population policy directed at reducing population by reducing immigration programs or by abandoning natalist policies, but this would run counter to those who argued that economic growth nationally was desirable and that the best way and the quickest way to achieve it was through growth in population. So such an approach has not been pursued by Australian governments. The massive extension of major metropolitan areas generated concern over the loss of urbanisation in the near city. Fertile areas that had been the sites of significant food supplies were lost to that urbanisation. The changing relative power, economic power between the Commonwealth and the states after World War II left the states under pressure to provide infrastructure. They adopted policies of privatising the provision of water supply, sewage and much of the transport infrastructure. In so doing, they departed from the traditional model of municipal funding and development of such services. The provision of urban services shifted from the government, including local government, associated with urban development, to the private owners of housing via the development companies which developed the estates. In this process, the massive increase in costs fueled an underlying pressure in house prices. This consequently led to increased significant interest in housing prices. But more importantly, it reduced the ability of cities to grow or operate in better balance with the environment. Rather than addressing the underlying cause of this failure of planning and the failure to recognise the increasing environmental stresses, governments sought to reduce environmental stress without considering alternative strategies. The consolidation policy we now follow was justified in part out of the belief that increasing the density would reduce the deleterious environmental stresses it was thought would accompany increases in population and their associated energy and water consumption. Detailed studies of domestic water consumption, including those currently underway in Canberra, reveals that higher density housing does not lead to reduction in per capita water consumption, contrary to what is popularly believed. The assumption that increasing density reduces per capita energy consumption is also not supported by empirical study, not only in Canberra, but in Sydney and in Melbourne and in Adelaide and some of in Perth. The embodied energy in higher density housing is significantly higher than in conventional housing due to the greater use of elaborately transformed materials and the lower use of renewable resources in their construction. The energy used for security and lighting in common areas and in operation of lifts and other forms of community facilities in high density housing also leads to greater energy consumption. The operational energy used in high density housing is often related to greater requirement for heating and cooling of apartments, especially those in sealed buildings. At times, the rationalisation for the policy includes claims that it would reduce the need for investment in a variety of urban services. Some even have argued that higher densities would make it easier to develop public transport systems that would consequently be better patronised. The falsity of this comfortable physical determinist assumption was exposed by Mies, including in relation to Canberra, in a recent paper, but is promulgated by many who, for a variety of reasons, persist in ignoring the evidence. There was a romantic notion that increasing urban density would lead to greater citizens' participation in urban life in the whole range of social and cultural pursuits in the city. The evidence that there is a higher level of disputes between occupants of strata title developments, whether they are horizontally defined or vertically, suggests that the argument that increasing density increases community engagement is flawed. No town planning authorities do any work in that area, including the local ones. Whether communities oppose the working out of the policy as it affects the quality of nature or their communities' governments and planning authorities respond by criticising the communities for being selfish and set about setting development targets for particular areas in the city. But what is the evidence? Well, when you look at water, the basic consumption of water for ingestion is actually very small and roughly the same regardless of dwelling type, income or wealth. That used for sanitation services is roughly the same regardless of dwelling type, income or wealth. There may be some small reductions of consumption for food preparation in households in high density housing, but that may be offset by the greater propensity to eat out, and that's not a question we're going to pursue here. The reduced competition for use of bathing and showering in higher density housing due to smaller household sizes compared with a higher level of social control in lower density housing, which results from larger household sizes, leads to a lower per capita bathroom consumption in conventional housing. Garden consumption is often assumed to be significantly higher for conventional housing than for higher density housing. It's clear, however, that many of the blocks of flats have garden developments that consume water. The occupants of high density housing frequently maintain a range of pot plants that, although small, may consume significant volumes of water. They also tend to take part in activities which are water using, but which are external to the living area of the apartment, but that's not taken into account. Households in high density housing, especially in multi-storey flats, usually don't receive a separate bill for their individual water consumption, but they receive one that is a share of that development, including the consumption for maintenance, cleaning and gardening for the development. They are thus more likely to behave in a way that creates a tragedy of the commons and more likely to be less parsimonious in their consumption behaviour, thus increasing total consumption. And when we turn to energy consumption, we know that can be measured in two ways. One, to look at the embodied energy in the development according to its density and the operational consumption of the different kinds of development. We do have some information about the levels of embodied energy for different types of density, which indicates that the energy consumption increases with density. The data from the domestic energy consumption of different densities of housing in a study being completed here reveals that the per capita energy consumption, that is for gas and electricity, measured in kilojoules per dwelling, was lower for traditional houses compared with the high density housing. When we turn to look at transport, the work by Mies indicates there's little evidence that increasing density leads to reduced transport demand or that it necessarily is directed to public transport. It's clear from the research evidence that the evident environmental sustainability arguments carry little weight in our present approach to the problems we face, leading to a conclusion reached by Neumann that the policy is built on a fallacy. So, what is the challenge for us as we face what is now compelling evidence of the need to act to reduce our pressure on the environment? It's clear that the present allegedly environmental basis of consolidation policies cannot achieve the desired reduction in environmental stresses, regardless of how you shift the figures. It seems to me, though, that we still have a chance to respond to the challenge presented by climate change. To do so, we need better information about the socio-political, economic pressures and processes that are at the core of our present problem. We not only need better research to produce the evidence of the present process, but we also need better trained people to engage with us in a necessary and appropriate conversation about the causes of climate change and how our own actions and aspirations need to change to address them. This is not a small task, but I believe that the kind of work in train here at Fenner is an important step in informing the public debate and in producing the necessary skilled researchers and planners to produce better environmental outcomes for our urban future. I was asked to indicate what kind of skills are needed to discharge these obligations. The first point I have to make is to answer the question posed at the beginning. That we are not ready to tackle the need to recognise that we are an urban society. The need is there, but as a society we have not recognised it nor have we accepted that we must change our course and behaviour if we are to survive on an urban planet. It seems to me that those of us in multidisciplinary research centres, centres like the Fenner School, not only have an obligation to conduct research in the way we interact with and change the nature of the environment, but and environmental processes, but we also have some obligation to actively engage in public explorations of those processes and ensure that the knowledge that, that they have helped develop is widely disseminated. This is saying that one obligation of those who work in publicly funded, whose work is publicly funded, as Fenner's is, have a duty to ensure that it's subjected to rigorous peer review and that once proved, given as much publicity as possible. Well, what kind of skills are needed? The first is to have an open mind and be committed to the scientific discipline of scepticism. This means the scholars in this area must always make a special attempt to contribute to a public debate, but always keep an open mind and be prepared to acknowledge that the scientific traditions and approach they employ can, indeed must, be enriched by scholars from disciplines not their own. The question that we were asked to answer five questions. The first one was, what kind of challenges will be awaiting us down the road? My answer to that is, many, and they are all interesting. Well, what are the new opportunities arising? What the answer would be, what kind would be the kind of research priority I would adopt? I would begin by exploring the natural demand for variety of service, ecosystem services such as water, to see if we can devise ways of minimising its consumption in urban areas without prejudicing the health objectives of the society. At the very least, it would force us to explore the efficacy of the Chadwickian solution to the demand for potable water and the management of human wastes adopted over 200 years ago and not subjected to critical review. At UAGL in its new formation could actually think that it would be a useful task. I would explore the nature of demand for energy consumption to see if there are ways of delivering energy for the variety of social purposes we have to improve to efficient production and distribution in forms that do little or no harm to the environment. I would also explore the form and structure of our cities to see if there are ways of distributing activities and consumption to minimise water and energy consumption. That would take me away from the present preoccupation with Civic as the centre of Canberra, which I'd remind the people of where the majority of the population of Canberra live, Tuggeranong, Belconnen, Woden and Gungahlin, I never figure in the diagram. And the myth that we have to be preserving the Griffin legacy, given that we've dishonoured it at almost every step along the way ever since it was first promulgated. And I would also explore the possibility of ways of urbanising food production. But that would mean that we'd have to explore ways of giving households security over their shelter. I'd explore ways of developing the cultural, more engaged society in which members would find opportunities for self-expression while also accepting that they are members of a community that accepts its obligation to fellow citizens. That would mean we would need to increase the democratising of decision-making so that as many people as possible could participate in decision-making about the nature and direction of the urban centres other than the way we currently manage that centralised role. Well, are we ready for an urban planet? Do we have sufficient scientific understanding of our cities as complex socio-economical ecological systems? Well, yes, but we need to have a socio-economic system less focused on personal greed as its motivation. Do we have a capacity to effectively plan, manage and govern our cities? Yes, but we need to develop a fundamentally different mode of political interaction and exchange. What kind of skills are needed and how can our education and training meet those challenges? Well, there are many skills required. They're all available here at Fenner, but it requires a different mode of socio-political interaction and exchange to be effective. In summary, it all comes down to political will. We cannot survive any kind of planet, let alone an urban one, if we do not quickly develop a more inclusive, democratic state in which personal and corporate wealth does not confer advantage over others. Thank you.
I guess you are all exposed to very sharply contradicting sort of views, and I guess many of you have very strong sort of urge to ask questions, but I would like to ask you to hold on for a minute, and I would like to invite Ed Boido to give our last presentation. Ed is asked to take our focus a bit away from Australia and ACT, and then look into organization challenges and opportunities in Asia Pacific. And here we highlighting what is actually happening in terms of urbanization in those regions, and also drawing on the project of CARE Australia is conducting there, what kind of role an environmental NGO and civil society can play in assisting the region to address those challenges.
Yes, mate, thanks. Thanks, everyone, and thanks for the opportunity to come and speak today from a perspective of a humanitarian organisation working in the region. So CARE is an international humanitarian and development organisation fighting global poverty. We have a special focus on working with women and girls to bring lasting change to their communities. Globally, we work in 82 countries with over 900 projects. But a bit closer to home, CARE Australia has a particular focus on Southeast Asia and also in Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea in the Pacific. While the majority of the poor people in these countries still live in rural areas, the region is home to some of the largest and most rapidly growing urban cities and urban regions in the world. Rapid urbanisation has huge implications for CARE's commitment to working with the poorest and most vulnerable. Particularly given the influence of climate change and extreme weather events and the impact that this is having on health and livelihoods. Although I'm far from being an urban specialist, my key message today is from the perspective of a poverty-fighting organisation, is that when we're thinking about our future in an urban planet at a time of rapid environmental change, we have to grapple with the issues of poverty, marginalisation, power and justice that are shaping cities in the developing world, as well as addressing the ecological sustainability of our cities, and addressing issues of production and consumption. In the next few minutes, I'll take you through some of the challenges and opportunities for poor women and men in an urbanising world. I'll also link and look at some links to some of the work that CARE is doing with marginalised urban women in Laos as a bit of an example. Although many of the climate change projects I work on are in rural areas, I frequently end up in the big cities of Southeast Asia, Jakarta, Hanoi and Phnom Penh. One thing that always strikes me is the huge contrast between high-end luxury and people living in poverty. When I was living in Hanoi, there was an explosion in the number of luxury cars on the streets, but at the same time, down the narrow alleys I walked through on the way to work, I would pass women burdened with piles of cardboard and plastic who depended on informal recycling in order to earn a living. Some of the challenges for these women were particularly stark as they tried to maintain their livelihoods during heavy rainfall, extreme cold and heat. While many of the countries in Southeast Asia are experiencing significant and by many means impressive economic growth, and some are now recognised as middle-income countries, income inequality, the gap between the rich and the poor, is becoming more evident with the increasing proportions of poor people living in cities. Another trend is that Asian cities are incredibly young and they're characterised by large youth populations of people between the ages of 15 and 30. Despite this, the majority of growth is still due to migration because Asian cities can be places of opportunity. And many women and men are drawn to them because of employment and education opportunities. While some move permanently, others move to seek livelihood opportunities during periods of food insecurity, and also seasonally, during rainy seasons where flooding and inundation by water can change the dynamics of livelihood opportunities in rural areas. Climate change threatens to decrease agricultural productivity and increase food security, as well as challenging the livelihoods and survival of poor people. This will prompt some to seek livelihoods, and it already is prompting some to seek livelihoods elsewhere. And if we follow current trends, a large proportion may end up in cities and industrial areas. At the same time, those without the resources to migrate may be trapped in areas where it is increasingly difficult to sustain their livelihoods and live with dignity. Often, new migrants to cities are among the poorest and most marginalised once they end up there. The urban poor are more highly exposed to climate shocks and stresses for a number of reasons. These include the fact that poor women and men often live in marginal areas in the urban landscape, on steep slopes, along riverbanks and transportation corridors, and in floodplains. Population density is often very high, and services and infrastructure, including water and sanitation, tend to be very poor. Many urban cities are low-lying and exposed to flooding and storm surge, and we often see, and will increasingly see in the context of climate change, that the poorest are hit first and they're hit hardest. Given urban residents' dependence on food purchases, food insecurity will increasingly become an urban issue. Poor households spend a high proportion of their income on food, sometimes as high as 70 or 80%. And this exposes them to risks from food price shocks. And also leaves people with smaller reserves to cope with other shocks, like illness of a family member, or the impacts of hazards like floods and cold snaps. CARE is working with local organisations and authorities to implement disaster risk reduction measures for people living in these settings and in urban areas, and safety nets for those most at risk, and also advocating for improved services for those at risk. But tackling vulnerability in urban settings requires us to go a bit deeper and explore the underlying causes of poverty and vulnerability. CARE understands poverty not only as a phenomenon of unmet needs, but also one of unmet rights. As CARE develops long-term programs in each of the countries where we work, we start with a thorough analysis of the underlying causes of poverty and social injustice. This includes using gender and power analysis to examine the impacts of policies, institutions, gender and social dynamics on socially and economically marginalized people, particularly women, in urban settings. This helps us identify entry points and opportunities for programming and advocacy to facilitate long-term empowerment and change. I'll just talk a little bit about how some of this is working for communities we're working with in Vientiane, in Laos. So in Laos, 45% of women in urban areas work in the informal sector and completely lack labour protection and social benefits. And the vast majority in the formal sector also work in low-paid jobs, such as in the garment sector, where they also have poor protection and benefits. Young women in Laos who've migrated to urban areas for work, often to support families and younger siblings, have limited support networks and are often working in unsafe environments. In Laos, gender and power analysis is being used to inform projects, including the Legal Awareness and Life Skills Project, which is being implemented jointly by CARE and the Laos Women's Union Vientiane. Some women who migrate to urban settings end up being involved in formal and informal sex work, as well as relationships where they experience sexual violence. This can lead to deep-rooted and wide-ranging stigma, overt discrimination, and barriers to accessing quality services. So I'll introduce you to Chansey. She's a 55-year-old woman and one of 8 members of the Laos Women's Union who participate in the Legal and Life Skills Project activities by volunteering as a legal literacy officer. She works alongside 23 other legal literacy officers and peer counsellors who are part of the project. Her role as a legal literacy officer involves implementing project activities with other officers in partnership with CARE, with the aim of raising awareness of the legal rights of women, especially women in the service industry and women engaging in formal and informal sex work. Chansey and the other legal literacy officers conduct outreach activities for women working in the service industries and sex workers to increase their understanding of legal rights, gender-based violence issues, and available social and health services. Many women and girls in communities know Chansey and the other legal literacy officers since the project has been introduced, and many women and girls have approached her to get help, advice and assistance, including when they face violence. As well as the direct services they provide, the literacy officers and the Laos Women's Union members are well known and recognised at high levels in government. They become involved in advocacy efforts to secure better responses from duty bearers to incidents of violence, as well as advocating for policy change with government representatives. To illustrate one of the changes in attitudes that has come about in recent years and during the project's life phase, last year at the iconic Mekong River Boat Festival, the Lao Women's Union entrance included both women from the Lao Women's Union and sex workers, which is quite a big move. And it symbolised the acceptance of these formerly excluded women into Lao society as valued women worthy of respect and protection. It since opened doors to dialogue with higher levels of government. So what does all this mean for organisations like CARE working on an increasingly urban planet? It means that we have to get better at looking at the complex relationships between poverty, migration, and marginalisation. This includes understanding how food security and climate change are affecting the complex relationships between rural and urban areas. It also means we need to look at the relationships between rural and urban areas in terms of the resources that cities are people living in cities are consuming. CARE's currently undertaking a project and a study called Where the Rain Falls, which is an 8-country study in partnership with the United Nations and University to understand rainfall variability, food security, and human mobility. Others, including IIED, the International Institute for Environment and Development, are looking at connections between urban food security and climate change. But there's a lot more to be done. We need to continue to advocate for climate change, gender, and power considerations to be central to social and planning policies and projects. We also need to continue to provide support to those who are most marginalised, without a voice or excluded from development processes. Finally, we need to make the most of the opportunities that urbanisation brings to mobilise people and ideas around social and environmental issues facing the urban citizens of developing countries. This can also involve tapping into the huge youth populations, drawing on their ideas and capacity, building their capacity, and also addressing sustainability and equity of consumption to ensure that cities are fast-tracked to be ecologically sustainable and just. So that's a little bit of our work. And if you're interested to find out more about our climate change or broader work, I'll leave you with those websites. Thanks very much.
So, any questions to the speakers and panelists? Yes.
The first question asked gets to a gift signed by the author. Without the author's permission.
Well, thank you very much. My question is to Rob, and it's about the interdisciplinary teams that are working in the new developments. I wondered what the role of horticulture and greening cities is having in mitigating climate change in the new developments.
Horticulture in mitigating climate change in terms of what, reducing food miles or...
Heat island.
So not only horticulture for food growing, it's just general. No, it's an area that we spend a lot of time on. In fact, the new development in Molonglo, one of the issues that we've taken on board, there's been some criticism about some of the earlier suburbs in Gungahlin, and there isn't the space to allow for trees. So we've certainly allowed widths of roads, and looking at some of the developments with water-sensitive urban design, having runoff from the roads can come into tree pits and rain gardens and things like that. It's certainly, particularly as we get into smaller block sizes, what remains in public open space, both on the roads and in parks and along river corridors and nature reserves, it becomes more and more important. So yeah, it's certainly something that we put a lot of effort into. And as we're moving into a more extreme climate, making sure that the species that we select are appropriate. Some of the species that were selected in previous times haven't necessarily performed as well. There's a bit of a tension also sometimes between choosing native species and introduced species. With the work that we've been doing on protecting solar access, there's some advantages in having deciduous trees both in the winter and the summer. And while it might be desirable for biodiversity purposes to have native trees, they're not necessarily the best species in a compact situation as a street tree. So identifying areas within the landscape where you can have large enough areas for biodiversity purposes, but then looking at what are the most appropriate species close to housing.
This is a question for Rob. Also, it's a bit of a loaded question. Do you consider, or does the government consider, the development of Molonglo to be centralised or greenfield development?
Yeah, well, I've heard it referred to as both. I couldn't speak on behalf of the government, but it's when you had those circles drawn, it was seen as a way of avoiding the... Well, there was nowhere else to go within the ACT, really. We've sort of... Gungahlin is now, in the next decade or two, will be fully developed. So there is potential, I guess, for development across the border, but that gets difficult, and it's not desirable for the ACT government because then we don't get the revenue. But the land has all become fragmented over the border. So in terms of where are the places to go within the ACT, the Molonglo Valley was one of the last opportunities. There's also Cohen Plateau, but that's a sort of so far away from the central core of Canberra, it's almost like a separate development. So Molonglo has been viewed as an opportunity to intensify to consolidate Canberra's growth, but in reality it's a greenfield development. It's brand new suburbs rolling out over the paddocks.
But in terms of a compact urban form, Molonglo has been very expensive to develop. It's not delivering affordable housing as such. It has a very expensive transport task ahead of it. Why do you think Molonglo proceeded perhaps Eastlake?
Well, I'm not in the planning department, so I couldn't say, but I do know that Eastlake's got a whole lot of complex issues, including contaminated soils, former garbage tips, and I think there's a lot of work to be done on that project before and the costs. So I think if you're looking at cost of development, but if you're driving, if you're a resident of Tuggeranong, if you're heading towards the city, Molonglo is really close. So I guess it's all relative. If you live in the inner north, it might seem like a long way out, but compared with all of Tuggeranong and the adjacent areas of Western Creek, it's viewed as quite central.
Pat, would you like to respond to that question? Well,
I'm interested in it because I think that, first of all, although the possibility of logical possibility of extending across to New South Wales was raised and then quickly dropped, for the political reasons which you were referring to, the reality is that if we were going to actually have a more environmentally sound development and with much greater use of around the public transport system, then that would have been a logical proposition, especially since we now get 25,000 vehicles a day coming from the Yass direction, which is a load for us, and it's a major problem for the poor buggers who are on that road, and it also increases the accident rate and so on, which one would have to take into account in terms of looking at the social consequences of it. But on top of that, I think that the other thing that worries me about that present approach is that still there's that preoccupation that which is the source of most of the inefficiencies in all of our cities. It's not simply Canberra, but the notion that you should centralise stuff and carry with it all the attendant consequences, costs of that, whether it's traffic congestion or whether it's problems of peaking in the water supply and sewage and power systems or whatever, they are simply washed away because of the preoccupation that we've got to pour all the eggs in one basket. So when we're looking at the development now, we're saying, well, there's a problem, and nobody looks at, what's the problem of Tuggeranong? Well, the problem of Tuggeranong is there's no employment. One of the reasons why there's no employment there, because we focused employment up in the CBD, or what is now seen as the CBD, when that wasn't part of the Griffin plan, wasn't part of anyone's plan for a long time, but all of a sudden it's changed. So, those things are all there and they do go to the issue of sustainability in the longer run, and not so long run, because those things are going to run out, and the low you might be able to put off the decision for another generation. That's kind of the limit to it. But my comments were not specifically directed to when I was talking. I wasn't specifically using Canberra as much of an illustration, because I was trying to point out that we're talking about an urban planet, an urban nation, an urban species, and that is extending outside the ACT boundary. So I'm actually looking at those other questions. So most of my research is not in Canberra, although I happen to have been asked to look at the energy and water consumption records, and a lot of what we're finding is counterintuitive. That is to say, people have a fixed idea and they work on that and don't actually look at the evidence. And I have to say, tragically, having been in the business for quite a while, the town planners are trained by architects, they're all in architecture faculties, they don't have any sense of critical analysis. That's not what they're there for. They're there to receive the wisdom, which they then go out and regurgitate without any critical reassessment. So they're not actually in a mindset to take that critical review of whatever they do. There's a paper coming out in June. If you want to see the long-winded discussion of that and why there's no money going into research into these questions, you should buy the June issue of Australian Urban Policy and Research, because some of us are worried about the lack of appropriate research focus on city problems, and find out what's the reason for the non-funding of research, which is clear if you look at the ARC figures.
I have three questions which are really not sure that any of the speakers are going to particularly be able to answer, but I just want to throw them into the mix. And I must say at the outset that I was pleased to hear to have Patrick and Ed here giving a broader than Canberra view to when we think of cities. I think the premise is, I'll keep my questions brief, seeing as I have three of them. The premises of the questions are obvious when you hear the questions. First question is, when are we going to move our cities onto less fertile soil? The second question is, when are we going to move our cities to higher ground? Particularly Australian question, not so much Canberra question. And the third question is, how are people going to maintain a respect for and a degree of concern for the environment, which is our true habitat, when we are increasingly urbanised?
Can I answer the first question? Canberra is already in pretty infertile soils in the first place. And, just try shifting Canberra, Sydney or Melbourne, it'll take you more than a long weekend. And as far as the second part of that question, the second point you made?
Higher ground.
Oh, whether...
Higher ground.
Well, Canberra's doing pretty well on that score. But I think that we have some distance to go, and that's... I've always thought it was something to do with the way we were settled, and the ships came, they made land, and then everybody was worried that they couldn't get on a boat to leave, so they cluttered around the point that they thought the next boat would come, just because we are all boat people here, and whether we like it or not, and have been for thousands of years. So why don't we understand that? There is a sort of a strong connection with trying to be by the coastline. That's why 90% of the population is within 10 kilometres of the ocean. How we get over that's another. I don't know, because it does involve a change, and part of my change is, well, we need to have smaller cities, which means I think that we're going to be in for a smaller population, and we need to prepare for that.
My previous work on coastal stuff, it's sort of disappointing that a number of state governments recently have gone backwards in terms of planning, allowing planning controls to go back to local governments, where there was some coastal mapping done. We've got an expert in the back of the room on some of this stuff, my former tutor. the coastal mapping and hazard mapping that was done and was starting to be implemented into planning schemes has been sort of overturned recently, which is disappointing, because we really need to look at that issue seriously. There's incredible vested economic issues, interests though in not making that data available, and development pressures in prime coastal areas. The other issue you've had mentioned about the tension between cities and valuable habitat and food growing areas is often this conflict within your questions there. We're addressing the issue, as all cities in Australia are, about trying to get growth in greenfields areas, to address Patrick's point that people still do want to live on detached housing, and which means they're going out into the fringes, which means you're up against ecological constraints in terms of the nationally recognised species that come under the Commonwealth legislation. So all of our fellow land development agencies are constantly grappling with that issue about how do we continue to be able to develop housing in greenfield areas where there is habitat. But what's going to be the priority? These are the sort of dilemmas that are facing us globally. Is it going to be more important to protect valuable species or to protect prime food growing areas if the population continues to grow? And yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer to it. This is an imponderable, I don't know, if you're, from your experience in...
I mean, one of the challenges as well that we've got is that with sort of some of the climate change scenarios that we're looking at, protection in place might not be a viable strategy forever. So some of that has to be planned. But the other challenge is that a lot of, you know, some of the most densely populated places on the planet are very low-lying, including a lot of Asian cities, but also including some Pacific islands as well. I guess looking at the challenges, there has got to be a look at who is most exposed to some of the hazards, and make sure that any migration or resettlement that's planned does take into account the needs, the history, and the rights of the people who are currently living in those areas that are exposed, and that, you know, loss and damage as a result of climate change is addressed in an equitable way.
I think that can I just buy into that a little bit? One of the things that we haven't looked at, but we haven't discussed tonight, but I've made a passing reference to it, but that's all, is that we're in a real dilemma, and it's a major conundrum for us, because we're very keen to develop technology which enables decentralisation. I mean, the broadband system should enable all sorts of decentralisation to take place. We already have a decentralised approach to manufacturing. So when you see someone who puts together a motor car, they're actually putting together the products of hundreds of little factories all over the place. They're brought together and assembled. Now, we do that in all sorts of ways. I mean, the motor car is an extreme example. We might be losing that particular illustration for our own economy right now. But there seems to me that there's a lot of potential in that, which if we took that to look at the way we organise ourselves, we would actually decentralise a lot of the administration of our cities, and they could be decentralised to regional centres and so on, in the areas where they wouldn't have the same kind of stresses on the environment that some of the developments now present. Now, that should become feasible and desirable, and we should be trying to set the parameters in place for that to occur, instead of seeing it as kind of a polarising thing. But I mean, that does mean we've got to take on the whole business about having the decisions being made by the centre of the city, or by the government being saying everything's got to be here. I can remember having some part in trying to decentralise employment for white collar workers. In particular in Sydney, but other cities. And the illustration I had was, I looked at the structure of those organisations. Basically, organisations like the Taxation Department are paper shuffling operations. A lot of unskilled or low-skilled workers, high proportion of them are women. Only 8%, 92% were in that category. Only 8% were high paid movers and shakers. Now, we argued that if you wanted to improve the quality of life and the range of cultural facilities and so on available in the western suburbs of Sydney, you should shift the taxation office to the west of Sydney, because the first thing that would happen is it would provide work for women who would then add to the family household income, which would itself become the yeast that would change the situation. Well, we did that. We put that office out there, and it slowly, and other departments were put out there for the same reason and had a similar beneficial effect. But within a generation, there was somebody who's lived on the North Shore of Sydney and was irritated by the fact that they had to get out to Blacktown or somewhere. And they set out to actually make sure that was reversed. So we ended up in situations where there's slow drift back to the CBD. No change in the production process, although there's now a few more computers, which actually makes it easier to be decentralised. But paradoxically, that's not what happens. The person who's at the top of the tree wants to sit on the top of the tree and gaze over the labouring masses, wherever they are, instead of seeing themselves as an important part of the decision-making apparatus. But the real functions of those people's got to be out there. So one thing we should be thinking about is how does the new technologies, what are the things we do, how do we reduce the stress on the environment? If we did that and looked at those technological developments and organisational developments, then we would greatly reduce the environmental stresses that we now experience in our cities. But it does mean that it wouldn't be, you know, the head honcho from Melbourne or from Sydney deciding what's going to happen for the 2.5 or 4 million people that are affected by the decision to stay there. I can take you through a whole series of illustrations of that kind, and throw your hands up in horror and think, here we are talking about an urban planet and what we're doing is buggering it before we've got off the ground.
I'm a high school teacher, and the Australian Curriculum Geography thing has just come out, and it's going into a lot of this area of sustainability and so on like that. The question I have is, do you know of anyone who's doing a good job of this tension between the fact that urbanisation is spreading over great agricultural land, the really high quality agricultural land? Is anybody around the world doing a good job of trying to corral that, the urbanisation and the agricultural land?
Well, I haven't got any illustrations of there being good jobs here, but you can find the illustrations overseas. I mean, the periphery, for example, of Washington, they have preserved urban farms for production of food that's consumed in Washington, the region. That means that those properties get a special rate concession, but it also means that they can't sell it for redevelopment for higher urban development. They have to, if it's sold, it's sold as urban farm, so it has a special valuation. Now, we don't use those kind of techniques to preserve the hinterlands of our cities, but we should think about those things. And I think that it's, given that the development of Sydney and Melbourne are now over the 4 million mark, and some of the other cities are roaring away as well, and none of them have got much in the way of environmental consideration, and even the lead city of Canberra doesn't have much in the way of real consideration for the environment. They're concerned about growth. They're still on that particular part of the diagram. And it's not just growth for the city as a whole, it's growth for the individual bits of the apparatus. It's individual agencies and departments that won't come to the, well, are not forced to come to the table on that issue. So I'm sorry, but I'm a bit dyspeptic on these kind of questions.
If I can add a bit to that, actually this morning I had a very interesting discussion with a reporter from Wall Street Journal, and he is asking me what is my opinion about a particular city in China who's trying to bulldoze off about 700 little hills and mountains and then create about 200 square kilometers of flat land so that they can develop that land. And I told him, I cannot directly comment on that particular city, but I do know why they're doing that. Because the Chinese government are trying very hard to control the conversion of fertile arable land into urban land. So the local government, they have no choice of, no easy available sort of land that they can urbanize. So what they can do is turn to the environmental or ecological sort of land, and they try to flag that up and then, you know, convert that sort of land to urbanization, sort of urbanized kind of land. So I would not say this is a sort of successful model in terms of preserving, you know, agricultural land, because by that sort of policy, actually, you're driving the local government to further into the more green sort of land, it seems like.
Yeah, it's a very difficult issue to grapple with. There's a number of cities in Australia that I know of have tried to establish green belts. Well, Sydney had one for a while, but eventually, and so in Adelaide and in Perth, and you have zonings, rural zonings, but ultimately it comes unstuck because the land value becomes too high. So even if it's zoned for rural, people start having horses on there for recreation rather than growing food, and then trying to circumvent the planning rules, and in the end, the city leapfrogs the green zone and it doesn't seem to make any sense, and that happened in the Sydney Green Belt, and Adelaide's tried it with their second generation parklands, but in the end the economics forces productive food growing out even if it's still zoned as rural, so it's a really tough one.
My question is to Mr. Boydell. You talk about working in Southeast Asia. Does your organization have any role at all in addressing the basic issues? Because I know very little about your work. I grew up in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. Yes. There are certain basic issues that are not being addressed. One of them is overpopulation. You talk about urbanization and you talk about people building houses. It's not like in a lot of the cities, as you know, there's no planning. The houses just go up overnight. Same in China, isn't it? In Vietnam, I was there last year. In Manila, you see, the problem is overpopulation. The rich, fertile soils. And now, when I was growing up, on the way to the International Rice Research Institute, they are now full of houses because people have to live somewhere. You see, it's not like here in Canberra where, you know, there are two people in a four-bedroom house. There are 10 people in a two-bedroom house. Yeah. See, so who is addressing the basic issues? Does your organization have anything to do with it, or it doesn't play a role in this at all? Maybe it's the people, it's the attitude of the people. And in the Philippines, of course, there's an extra thing because it's predominantly Catholic country. I mean, you can have as many children as you want. You know, Marcos tried limiting it to 3, but unless you have a dictatorial government, you can't stop these people from building houses where you're supposed to plant food.
Yeah.
So does your organization have any role in that at all, or you do just do Band-Aid?
No, I mean, in terms of fundamentals, I guess different people talk about the fundamental basics in different ways. If you go down to the basic sectors where we're doing a lot of work, they include primary education and education for minority groups, livelihoods, access to clean water and sanitation. But within this broader framework of, you know, women's empowerment and addressing deeper rooted gender inequalities, a large part of that work includes work on sexual reproductive and maternal health. But the angle we come at SRMH from is, you know, from the perspective that this contributes towards a woman's fundamental right over the control of her own body. And so a lot of the sexual and reproductive health work we're doing is, we do see it as a key part of women's empowerment and allowing women and families to make informed decisions, including about when and how many children they have. So I guess you could say that we are grappling with this, but we're always working mindful of the context of the countries we're working with, working in. So in some countries, this work is easier than others. And often, like as you say, religion can play quite a large part, and also government policy can also play a large part in sexual and reproductive health decisions. So I guess by trying to address some of the causes of why people don't have access or the ability to make decisions about these issues, we are hopefully contributing to this bigger picture of population, but from the perspective that first and foremost comes a woman's right to have control over her own body.
I'm very mindful of our time. We're about 20 minutes over running our set time. So thank you all three speakers.